What is up, ladies and gentlemen? This is the QTR Podcast. We got a banger today, folks. We got the motherfucking Montana Skeptic in the house. It is February 20th. In case you can't tell, I am stoked to be here. Let's review a couple pieces of very quick housekeeping before we get to the legendary man himself. First and foremost, this podcast is brought to you by none other than, if you are listening and you are enjoying it, you have my patrons to thank. Those are the kind folks that sign up on Patreon. They donate a small recurring sum to the podcast. They are the capitalistic engine that keeps this sumbitch well-oiled and running. You know what I'm saying? Real quick, I want to shout out my friends over at Quantamize.com, Quantamize. Quantamize.com is a badass quantitative analysis research platform, the likes of which was formerly only reserved for people of the hedge fund ilk, you know, the type of people that go out and play squash instead of playing tennis. Your Brooks Brothers shoppers, if you will. So if you want to stick it to the man and stick it to those people in particular, you can go check out Quantamize.com, 10,000 stocks, options, and crypto. There is a free trial link in my podcast description. They are fantastic people. They have been huge supporters of the podcast. I enjoy speaking to them. And I will give them a shout out for recently winning Benzinga's, I forget what the award's called, but basically Benzinga gave them award for being the best platform outside of the Bloomberg Terminal or better than the Bloomberg Terminal. The point is, they're kicking ass and taking names, and it's much cheaper than a Bloomberg Terminal, especially if you use the free trial link in my podcast description. Number two, I want to thank my brother over at the Behind the Bid podcast. Link is also in my profile. Behind the Bid is a daily pre-market YouTube show for traders and investors. So if you're a day trader, worth checking out as part of your morning routine. They usually cover 8 tickers and news and sentiment. They give you a nice little 10-minute pre-market wrap-up of everything that's going on. They spend probably about a minute per ticker. They give you their thoughts and their ideas so they're not wasting your fucking time in the morning. 10 minutes in and out. You won't feel a thing, I promise. And you go into your trading day a little bit more knowledgeable than had you have not watched it. So what's up to my friends over at the Behind the Bid podcast? I also want to shout out my friends over at Corvus Gold, my brother Scott Corsi, author of Debt Slave Economics, my fine friends over at Investors Underground who recently signed up as patrons today. I appreciate you guys, Nate and the whole crew over there. Those are the guys that put together the Traders for a Cause conference. There's a link to them in my podcast description too. Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, and Russ Valenti, four of the other big swinging ding-dongs that helped me keep the podcast going. And also want to shout out my most recent patrons. My brother Paul Schust came through for me. I appreciate him very much. I want to say what's up to Money Lobster. I want to say what's up to Andrew Lukers. What's going on, Andrew? To these nuts. I want to say what's up to these nuts. You can't argue with that. Mike Tocheri, what's going on, brother? Way to join up on Valentine's Day, showing me some Valentine's Day love. I appreciate that. Patrick Flynn, my brother William McBrien signed up. My friend Devin Pearson, doesn't matter whether you are a man or a woman, Devin, Mr. or Mrs. Unisex name, because it's 2019 and gender doesn't matter anymore because it's all love on the QTR podcast. Fornarowski, whatever your name is, I appreciate your patron. Jonas Giese or Jonas Geese, I appreciate you, my friend. My brother Harrison or possibly my sister Harrison actually signed up. Or possibly my non-gender denominated friend Harrison signed up. My friend Ned DeLorme signed up. Stephen G is in the house. And I will give a couple more shout outs and we'll get on with the goddamn show, folks, because nobody wants to listen to this shit over and over and over, do you? I know you don't. Right now you're thinking, wish you would just shut up. Start the interview. I'm here for Montana Skeptic. Don't give a fuck about the patrons. But my podcast, my rules. So I'm going to shout out Rideshare Consultants NZ because they've been coming through. My friends at Interstellar Ginger Beer, whatever you guys are doing, I support it. Please send me a keg if you're brewing something. I hope you are. My friend Andre Gagnon's in the house. Doug Christensen's in the house. JD Teed is in the house. William French is in the house. Franz Xavier Hubert is still in the house. My brother Max motherfucking Mulvihill still riding. What's up, Max? My friend Chris Schaefer, I think he quit last month, but whatever. I'm going to shout him out anyways because I appreciate his previous patrons. My buddy Trevor Courtney sent me a message today. I didn't get back to him. Sorry about that, brother. I had a busy day. Walter Bullhouse says what's up. William Hild is in the house. Michael Embley is in the house. Joel Case is in the house. David Drumright's in the house. And that is the maximum. I can't do any more than that. My fucking head's going to explode, and you're going to get bored and turn this thing off. Numbers two, oh, forgot to turn these speakers off. Don't mind that, folks. Very unprofessional operation here. We're almost about to get started. Before we do, just want to remind you, this is not financial advice, okay? We are going to be talking about finance stuff, but it isn't financial advice. If you don't have the brain power to separate those two things, then you have probably bigger problems to worry about in your life, like walking and chewing gum at the same time. But I will just repeat it again for those that don't get it. This podcast is not investment advice, and I am not an investment advisor. So there it is. And I'm sure Mr. Montana Skeptic feels the same way. Finally, folks, I do encourage a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. We are 5.5 minutes in. Don't you think it's time to get some content in here, folks? I do too. So why don't we get this party started? Ladies and gentlemen, live from an undisclosed underground bunker somewhere in Montana, we have the one, the only, the legendary Montana Skeptic on the line. What is going on, my friend? How are you?
Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well, actually, and I hope you don't mind that I say on the air that in our 30-second pre-podcast phone call, you told me you were having a little wine, so I decided to also go and indulge myself with a little wine. I hope you don't mind.
Sorry that my bad habits are catching on.
It's all right. I would actually argue that those are good habits, but beauty is in the eye of the bag holder, right?
It is.
So, we got a lot to talk about, my friend. Certainly, the last time you were on the podcast, we spent a lot of time talking about what you thought of Mr. Dane Butswinkus's arrival at Tesla. And here we are a short time later, and we will be discussing what you think about Mr. Dane Butswinkus's departure from Tesla.
Yeah, I'm glad you remembered that. We did talk about it. Let's preface this, both of us.
Sure.
Like a caution, because this morning there's this astonishing news that the general counsel has resigned. It appears for all the world like it was triggered by the continuing insouciance or defiance of Elon Musk about the consent judgment he signed and about his obligations regarding, you know, truthful tweeting. Particularly last night, his tweet that Tesla would build 500,000 cars this year. She had to walk back a little bit later. So that's amazing news coming at a time when we see a really shocking collapse in Tesla demand in the United States. And all indications are that Tesla's demand is not only really weak in Europe and in China, but that Tesla is having a difficult time delivering those cars, and that when people receive them, particularly in Germany, they're discovering they have lots of problems. So with all of that going on, right, you would say the stock price probably took a hit today. Well, I mean, it was down maybe 1% today. It's still trading above 300. None of this matters. So we should preface it by saying, until any of this finally matters, none of it matters. We're just discussing the things that might apply to a normal company. Now, I think it will matter, and it will matter in a big hurry, and no one will be able to see it coming hardly, once it's clear that Tesla is a broken growth story. And we can talk about that later in the podcast. But I think it's important to point out that even though all these absurd things keep happening, it appears that the share price is impervious to any of that.
Well, and that's one of the fascinating things, right? The market doesn't seem to give a shit. And if you had told me this morning that this is what was going to happen, I heard rumors that I can not confirm that Butswinkus's departure may have been in the works prior to Musk making that tweet last night. So as far as it concerns people thinking that that was the straw that broke the camel's back, I heard some unconfirmed rumors that that may not have been the case, and that I'm sure that will come out in due time. What I will say is, if you had told me that, I mean, I think first and foremost, just coming out and making that tweet last night and saying that they're going to, very clearly, I reread it several times, he makes a definitive, unqualified statement that they're going to make 500,000 vehicles this year, and then 4 hours later walks it back in a fashion of like, oh, well, what I meant to say was like, oh, I was just a little bit off. It's like, no, you said one thing, and now you're saying something completely different to the tune of 20%. And the second thing is, you know, if you had told me that Buswinkis was going to leave, and by the way, also, too, everyone keeps saying he was there for 2 months. I think he didn't start until late January. So he was really, I think, employed and active as an employee for 3 or 4 weeks. If you had told me that was going to happen, I would have said the stock would be down 10%, because this is the guy that's standing between Elon Musk and possibly major regulatory and legal action. But alas, as you've said, the market doesn't seem to care.
Yeah. Well, I was actually not surprised. I was actually, pleasantly surprised the stock was down at all today in a slightly up market. But what I did do is I dove back into those consent judgments that Tesla signed and Musk signed back in September after the SEC had sued them, and which was a fascinating history. If you remember, the SEC sued and had very detailed allegations. And Musk basically said, this is all nonsense. And he told his board to back him up. And the board said, we back you up fully. And then the share price tanked dramatically. And they all came crawling back on broken glass to the SEC and signed it all up on Saturday. Anyway, what those consent judgments that they signed say, here's Tesla's. It says, within 90 days of signing this, so that's passed, Tesla undertakes to, among other things, implement mandatory procedures and controls to oversee all of Elon Musk's communications regarding the company made in any format, including but not limited to posts on Twitter, and to pre-approve any such written communications that contain or could reasonably contain information material to the company or its shareholders. So is the number of cars Tesla will produce this year material to shareholders, most obviously? Did the board implement these mandatory procedures and controls? Well, I'm guessing it did, because it was required to so certify to the SEC. Was the board afforded an opportunity by Elon Musk to pre-approve this written communication he made on Twitter? Well, it most evidently was not. So, well, what about Elon Musk's obligations? His consent judgment, he undertakes, again, to comply with all mandatory procedures implemented by Tesla, the ones we just read about, regarding the oversight of communications relating to the company made in any format, including but not limited to posts on social media, for example, Twitter. And to comply with the pre-approval of any such written communications that contain or reasonably could contain information material to the company or its shareholders. So what Musk did last night is, to me, the clearest, most blatant, most obvious breach of his consent judgment with the SEC. And just looking at that, it really puts the SEC in a quandary. They are trying to get, management of companies, non-celebrity management, mostly of companies all over the U.S., publicly traded companies, to comply with the securities laws to not disseminate materially inaccurate information. And you've got the most famous CEO in the universe flaunting his consent judgment with them.
Right.
Right? I mean, a guy named Matt Levine at Bloomberg wrote a brilliant and wickedly funny piece today about this. And I hope
Was that the Bloomberg opinion piece?
Yeah, it was called Elon Musk Can't Help Himself. And Chris, when we're done, I would ask you to go ahead and put a link to that in the thread that has our podcast link that people can read it. But he talks about the dilemma the SEC is in. And he says, he, like me, by the way, agrees that the SEC let Musk off lightly and let Tesla off lightly, but that it was probably the right thing to do, because you would have hurt the company and its shareholders a lot more.
Right.
By, for example, removing Musk, since he is the charismatic visionary leader that is that levitates the entire enterprise. On the other hand, the SEC cannot allow this kind of flagrant, you know, misbehavior to go on. It's wrong. It's bad for the investing public. It's bad for the investing environment. And you either have rules and laws or you don't. So he suggests maybe what the SEC ought to do is, you know, maybe fine Musk $200 million this time and say, okay, now does that hurt enough? Do we have to do more?
Right.
Or perhaps even bring the directors into this. You know, as he says, shouldn't they be, you know, acting like directors? I'm quoting him. Shouldn't they be supervising the CEO and making sure their company complies with the terms of the settlement?
Don't they have a fiduciary obligation to do so?
Yeah, and he points out that the board does not seem to be adding much value or taking its role at all seriously. And you and I have discussed this before, but I have never seen. I'm sure there are worse boards of director out there. You know, I'm sure there are many examples in the history of corporate misbehavior. But boy, it would be hard to top this board in terms of indolence and in terms of utter reckless somnolence. They're all asleep at the wheel. Yeah. They are letting Musk run the show. And Butzlinkus, I think, you know, got in there and fought the good fight and tried to take it seriously as assuming he was the Twitter sitter. We don't know for sure he was, but he probably was. Yeah. And, you know, Musk put him in an impossible position. But I think I praised Butzlinkus pretty highly the last time we talked. I think really highly of him. I think really highly of his law firm. I'm confident in his integrity. I thought he would take the job seriously. I thought it was a really smart hire for Tesla, even though he's not a corporate attorney. He's a litigation attorney, because the company faces such a deluge of litigation right now, and it's good to have somebody, you know, directing traffic at the intersections who knows what they're about and who can make sure that the plan in lawsuit A does not collide into the plan in lawsuit B.
Right.
But farewell to him, and hello to this young guy. I mean, yeah, 40 is not that young, but he spent a grand total of 3 years in private practice, and that is nothing, okay? That's nothing. So his real experience has come just at Tesla, and 99 out of 100 times, a guy like this is just going to be run over. And if it's Elon Musk who's doing the driving, it's 100 out of 100 times. So you now have a 34-year-old CFO and a 40-year-old general counsel. It's a recipe for more, you know, recklessness. It's a recipe for allowing Musk to do what he's doing, driving this enterprise at 100 miles an hour straight for the cliff.
Well, and just to go back to what we talked about on our last podcast, I was in agreement with you that bringing somebody with Butzwinkus's pedigree in was probably, if I could fill one role at the company with somebody that has a substantive and lengthy and seasoned background, you could argue that bringing somebody in the GC position would be almost more important than bringing somebody in the CEO position, because yeah. You're immediately, you know, it's kind of like a hard edge that you're setting right there in terms of legal liabilities and in terms of what would be acceptable and what would not be acceptable at the company. So I was in agreement with you that bringing this gentleman in, who I'm sure is a very highly respected and fantastic professional, was a good idea. What I tweeted out today, and you know, I was specifically interested in your opinion on this because you have 3 decades of experience in the legal field as a trial lawyer, and you know, you have a law degree from Yale. So what I was interested in asking you about was, is there any way? Somebody tweeted out today that, you know, guys like Butzwinkus, they come in and they take a very hard-nosed, conservative look at things. And litigators and lawyers of his pedigree and his experience, they're airtight in terms of leaving themselves open to liability. They just don't do it. They're, you know, they're so well-versed in the law, and they're so, you know, they have such experience that they enter into airtight situations where they're not going to be put in a compromising situation. So to see somebody of his stature and of his experience kind of basically go in one end of the revolving door and come out over the course of 3 or 4 weeks, I mean, what the hell could have happened in 3 or 4 weeks that would cause such a quick change? And also, you know, to me that says, you know, and also in the Wall Street Journal article, it said the culture was an issue. To me, it's like what you just said. It can't help but feel like it's Elon Musk versus anybody that tries to defy him by bringing common sense and reason into the door. I mean, yeah. And that's circumstantial, but do you get that impression?
Well, let me back up a little bit. First, I've never met Dane Butsinkis. And second, of course, you know, trial lawyers are, it's a wide-ranging bunch of personalities. But from what I have read about Butsinkis, especially a trial lawyer who does a lot of complex civil litigation, my sense is that he is a prudent and careful guy. He's the kind of person who frequently has to talk his clients into the wisdom of settling a case, which is never easy to do.
Right.
And, you know, it's really important to a trial lawyer to get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth from your client, number one. And number two, to have a client who is going to listen to you, okay? And the celebrity, visionary, genius founder, or, you know, now that he has the right to call himself founder of Tesla, is never going to listen to you. I think Butsinkis had to be worried about that when Musk got on TV and said, I do not respect the SEC. But what happened yesterday, I think, was enough to push him over the edge. You had Elon Musk do his love fest with Cathie Wood of ARK Invest, where he said, yes, we're going to have full self-driving by year end. Utter, total bullshit, if I can use that word.
You can, and you're encouraged to.
Yeah, he said, Chris, you know, actually, a lot of people wish that that our, you know, that we had PG-rated podcasts. I do my best on my end. Anyway, he, in this Cathie Wood love fest, Musk said, we'll build 1.5 million cars in 2021. I mean, both of those things are an absolute fantasies, especially for this company spending nothing on growth capex. It is crazy for this guy to be saying stuff like that. And, you know, when I went and looked at these consent judgments again, I saw that it was not only the written communications that are supposed to be pre-approved, but also things he says on investor calls, okay? And it's not limited to that. It's anything he does in social media, okay? But it, that includes investor calls. Well, you know, maybe there's a difference if you say it instead of write it, okay? But that, the Cathie Wood thing took place yesterday. And let's remember back a few weeks ago to the January 30 quarterly conference call. He had, he was all over the map about how many cars Tesla was going to produce. Maybe you can get away with it because you had just put out a written statement saying, well, our guidance is 360,000 to 400,000. But in that conference call, he went from like 500,000 to 700,000. Crazy numbers. I want to also point out, you know, in that conference call, I think there's something that's going to come back to haunt Elon Musk and come back to haunt Tesla. And those were his answers to the questions by the Goldman Sachs analysts. David Tamburino.
Yep.
And here's the Q&A. Tamburino says, so like orders above, I think I've seen like 20,000 order levels for Europe and single-digit thousands for China. Is it better than that, Elon? Now, single-digit thousands, that's like, you know, 9,000 or fewer, right? Elon Musk, yes, absolutely.
Yep.
That was his answer. I am telling you, all the data that we see in Europe and China suggests that those were flat-out total lies. And, you know, that's 10b5 stuff again. And if and when this European demand story plays out, and it's evident to everyone that the demand isn't there, and Tesla has to offer a lower cost car than it's offering right now, people are going to start asking questions here and doing discovery and finding out whether Elon Musk told the truth. Anyway, that got off on a sidelight.
Well, I think just to comment on that real quick, I think Tamburino was masterful about the way that he asked that question, because when he asked his preliminary question and he started to allude kind of, you know, he didn't telegraph completely where he was going, but he asked it like a defense attorney would ask during a cross-examination. He didn't lead Musk to the answer, but he danced around the point he wanted to get to at first, and then having already committed Musk to a path, he kind of, it felt like he was gunning for Musk there. I think it was a masterful way to position that question, and I completely agree with you. That was an answer that stood out to me like a sore thumb.
Well, I'm gonna disagree slightly with you. Yes, mm-hmm. It's like a sore thumb. I think Tamburino was trying to, you know, Musk is so evasive about demand, and he was trying to get answers. And so the first thing he said was, "Great, thanks for taking the questions tonight." Okay, thank you, Elon. First thing I want to just understand is on what you're seeing from European orders and China orders so far. There are some numbers that get thrown around, but you guys are obviously taking a look at it.
Right.
That's nice. It sets a stage. Yes, you are. Musk doesn't say, "Oh, no, I have no idea."
Right, exactly.
But later on, he says, "Yeah, we're not even trying." How is that order profile shaping up relative to what you saw in the U.S. with the launch of the 3? That was his opening question. And I think what he did was he tried to set it up so that he couldn't be evaded. His questions became narrower and
exactly.
narrower.
Exactly. Yep.
And, you know, I just think he was being a good analyst. But as far as a good defense attorney, no, you never ask an open-ended question. You only ask leading questions when you're on cross. There are very few exceptions, and you should never – there should be some.
Obviously you know better than I would. But I just thought, you know, I thought the way that he whittled away at what he was getting to, I just thought was masterfully done. And as it was unfolding – I was in the shower and I was playing the conference call over the speakers in the bathroom. And as it was unfolding, I was like, and then he asked the next question. I was like, like, okay. So I like that a lot. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe in fact you will see, you know, 30,000 orders in Europe and 15,000 in China, and I'll be wrong.
Well, I want to go back to the Cathie Wood podcast in a second, but while we're still on the conference call, I wanted to get your thoughts on two things. One was obviously the absurd way that the chief financial officer of the company was announced to be retiring. And the second was his comment on reservations being irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people have commented on both those things. I don't have anything new or interesting to say about them. Obviously, leaving the announcement of the Ahuja departure to the very end meant that nobody could ask any questions about it in the call. I think that was a deliberate strategy. I noticed that Ahuja did sign the 10K, which is decent of him, I guess. In terms of, you know, the absurd thing he said, well, you know, the demand for our cars is insane. It's simply that people can't afford it, I think, is what it boiled down to. You know, that's a problem. Rolls-Royce has too. I don't know what to say. It was one of the stupidest things I've ever read or heard. Both. So
he said there's plenty of demand. The inhibiting factor is that people can't afford it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when for a guy who knows everything, it's astonishing
exactly. The
fundamental things about economics he doesn't understand.
And that's not even – you could argue that's class one, econ 101, entry-level undergrad economics, right? Yeah.
So you had a question about Cathie Wood's little love fest.
Yeah, so I mean just to go back to what we were talking about – I just didn't want us to get off track. We were, you know, obviously talked about his absurd tweet from last night and how that tied into Butsoinkus's resignation, how it may or may not have, but I wanted to know if you listened to the podcast and if you could flesh out your thoughts on it a little bit more, aside from what you've obviously taken exception to already. Just the fact, well, let's just talk about the fact that this woman who is, you know, he's entertaining this woman who has a $4,000 price target on the stock and still feels the need.
Go ahead. In fairness, you know, her bear base case is $700. So if everything goes to hell, then it's only $700. Listen, I met Kathy Wood at the Robinhood conference back in October when she was on the Tesla debate panel along with Trip Chowdhury and on the bull side, and Gordon Johnson with me on the bear side. She's a nice person. And I'd prefer just to leave it at that.
All right. We can do that. Did you catch Phil LeBeau's take this morning on CNBC? When we go back to the stock price not reacting. Did you happen to catch his how he reported it this morning?
Well, you know, I think Phil LeBeau is every bit as intelligent and insightful and honest as Kathy Wood. And I will leave it at that. No, right. I'll say more. That guy beclowns himself every day. That was just what a total shill he is. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for CNBC. Between him and Andrew Sorkin Ross or Ross Sorkin, they just need to at some point fall out of love with Elon Musk a little bit. Neither of them can help themselves. Sorkin is slightly better, trying to do a little bit of on the one hand, on the other hand. And, gee, Elon, you're such an incredible genius. Could you just stop lying? You know, that's Sorkin still believes Elon Musk is a genius. And if you still believe Elon Musk is a visionary genius leading us to the promised land, we have just a totally different viewpoints. There's no way to reconcile them until you see that you're wrong or I see that I'm wrong.
And when you think about like all the things that could go wrong for a public company, like if you objectively look at the facts here, right? And here's a guy, like we said on our previous podcast, that could come in to kind of clean up the mess because, hey, the company is a dorm room. You know, the companies, there's pizza boxes laying all over the place and empty beer cans. So this guy was going to come in and clean it up. And then he leaves 2 months later, and LeBeau's basically, the way he reports it is, people shouldn't be surprised. That's the first thing that he says, because there's been so much executive turnover at the company. And I think Yahoo Finance reported today something like 45 major executives over the last 14 months.
Yeah. You know, don't let this multiple shooting scare you away from that neighborhood, because there have been so many people murdered there this year.
It's such, and you start to wonder whether or not it becomes so egregious. You start to wonder whether or not, you know, what's the thought process behind somebody reporting it like that? Does he just not objectively see how insane this is?
I live in a privileged world because I don't have cable. I don't watch CNBC. I don't watch live television ever. I saw a fragment of the Kathy Wood interview with Elon Musk. I couldn't, it would have been too painful to listen or watch the whole thing. I did read a great summary of it, for which I was grateful. Somebody summarized it. It did a brilliant job on Twitter. I think it was "Does a Bear Something or Other in the Woods," and he did a really great job, or she did a great job. Anyway, the noise that comes out from the Jim Cramers and the Phil LeBeaus and the Gene Munsters and the Andrew Ross Sorkins, and it's endless. And the shilling will not stop until they're on to their next shill. And, you know, I'm just glad to be spared all of that. But it makes people stupid. I think if you're watching that stuff, turn it off. It's just making you stupid. Tune out the noise.
Do you think you think the average investor, the guy who's not, you know, a day trader, that's not engrossed in the financial industry, you know, the kind of guy that would tune into CNBC and take Phil LeBeau's advice because he's on TV and he's wearing a tie, do you think those investors understand the possible quandary that the SEC is in here in terms of, you know, you were saying before, like, look, we're either going to have rule of law here in the securities industry or we're not. Do you think people understand kind of the dynamic of the SEC's resources and time versus a CEO of this magnitude and, you know, somebody that is as rich as he is? Because you can still argue the SEC is the governing regulator here, and ultimately they've got the last call. But as far as stacking somebody up against the regulator, if anybody can, you know, if anybody could do battle with the SEC, it would be somebody like Musk. He's rich. Like you said, he's a celebrity. He's untouchable in the public eye. And he has the, you know, gravitas, for better or for worse, to make the SEC look stupid to the person that doesn't understand what the hell is going on. You know, somebody left me a Twitter comment today, like, you know, why is everybody obsessed with Elon just doing these little things? I mean, people don't understand that these are repeated violations of securities laws. You think people understand that dynamic?
I think mostly they don't. And it's not surprising. Honestly, the world of finance is, you know, people who are doctors understand a great deal about being a doctor of whatever kind of doctor they are. People who are architects, you know a huge amount about the particular area they practice in. If they're engineers, they know about that. If they change tires, they know a lot about that. If they fix cars, if they, whatever job they have, if they're a chef, if they're whatever they happen to do. But the world of finance is completely confusing to people. The idea that, you know, bond prices move the opposite way from yields, you know, is like, what? Explain that again.
Right.
Never mind the idea, what is a stock worth? You know, if you try to say to somebody, what is a stock worth? How many will ever say to you, well, let's see, I think what I might do is take the future stream of dividends or distributions I would get and any terminal value, and then I would discount that back to present value using some rate that we could both discuss. Nobody thinks like that, and it's all a mystery to them. And they just read that this guy is a genius, and that's the depth of understanding most people have, which is why it's so important for people like Jim Cramer to stop misinforming the public. Same goes for Phil LeBeau. He's got this platform, and even though he's an idiot, and Phil, you are an idiot, he should just stop. You know, he should just be more responsible. It's terrible. It's terrible.
You know, this is why I do the podcast, right? This was my last podcast. I don't know if you listened to it. I'm sure you didn't, but it was about Jim Cramer's comment coming out and saying the stock market is not in a Fed-induced bubble right now. And I just took one look at that and I was like, how could you possibly say something like that to these people that don't know any better and don't have the sophistication to understand what's going on? And you know that he does. Right. You know, he has the education and the sharp elbows, and he's a former fund manager, and he was a short seller, and he was into some, you know, not so nice things, based on his own words, what he said on this YouTube video where he was on the street TV. You see something like that, and then you see what he comes out and he tells the public, you know, we're not in a Fed induced bubble. And he says it very matter of factly, you know, and like. Yeah. I just think
I sort of like Jim Cramer, the person. I'm just talking about, you know, the guy who gives advice on TV. But, you know, the thing about the Fed-induced bubble, I mean, the Fed came out today and basically said, well, yeah, the patient is comatose, but it looks like we think we're going to keep in a coma for at least another year. So, you know, plan accordingly. And that's how I read the Fed meeting notes today.
Oh, yeah. Maybe you have a different. But, you know, I mean, look, what good does that do you? They're thinking about the next 12 months. They're not thinking about the next 12 years. Nobody's worried about the consequences over the course of the long term. But just to circle
fairness, this Fed did not create the problems it is now saddled with. And certainly the chairman of the Fed, he inherited this stuff from his two predecessors. So I feel sorry for him. I mean, he's in a bad spot.
Well, I just want to circle back and ask you about what you think the media's role has been in perpetuating, you know, this, what we believe to be horrible public misconception of how Tesla is valued, what, you know, what the behavior has been of Musk and others at the company. You know, what's the media's responsibility specific to Tesla?
Well, first of all, let me say, I think the media is, it's like the lawyers. There's lots of different ones and they do different things. And there have been some reporters who from the very beginning have done a brilliant job of reporting fairly and accurately on Tesla with a focus on the facts. And today, if you look at the articles being published, a woman, Alexandra something or other at Bloomberg, wrote a lovely piece where she went out and called 17 people on the phone and asked them about their experience trying to get a refund from Tesla, okay? Dana Hull has written a lot about the executive departures. Liam Denning has written some really sharp pieces about a lot of things about Tesla that cause him to sometimes scratch his head and be skeptical. Laura Kolodny and Lynette Lopez do really courageous work. Charlie Grant and Russ Mitchell and Neil Boudet are doing really terrific and courageous work. So there's a lot of reporters who I think are doing a great job. But in a large part of the media, Elon Musk, and again, people who just do not understand finance, have never looked at a 10K, don't have any. If you ask them, they would think Tesla's a brilliantly profitable company.
Right.
They have turned, he has become a charismatic, religious cult leader. And that's how they conceive of him. And, you know, he complains about the bad press he gets and says he's going to form Pravda to start striking back and starts to dox people or criticize people. No one has gotten more adulatory press coverage than Tesla and particularly Elon Musk. It is as if they created the earth, and on the, you know, they are just given credit for so much genius. You know, GM designed and built this car back with the EV1. Then Mercedes and Toyota came along and helped him put together his first Model S. The Model 3, where he's absolutely been on his own, finally, is really a piece of garbage. And he's engaged in this huge, undertaking of brand destruction by failing to, do a parts process to validate it and to test it. You now have people very distraught with the fact that their cars are performing poorly, that they're breaking, that they can't get repair parts, that they have to wait endlessly for service. So, this guy has been the beneficiary of a adoring press coverage, but I think the financial press, a large part of it, is waking up to him. Sorry for such a long answer.
No, it's your podcast, brother. That's, I want long answers from you. So I want to just go back to what you were saying about this article about the reporter contacting 17 people about their refunds that they've requested. I didn't see this article today, so I was wondering if you had read it and what it said.
Well, it was I think the reporter writes for Bloomberg, and what she did is simply, you know, there have been endless anecdotal reports. You read them on Twitter, I'm sure, of people who want to recover their deposit for one reason or another. They either need the money or they're tired of waiting so long or they're upset that the cost of the car, you know, they were promised a $35,000 Model 3 that would come with a $7,500 federal income tax credit, and now they're not going to get that and or anything close to it, and they want their money back. And they request their deposit, and in some cases, I mean, the person at the – one of the people in the story was in Australia and had a nightmarish experience – excuse me, South Africa. Several were in the U.S., and they waited months and sometimes up to a year to get their deposit back. I'm not saying it's, you know, why is that? Why? Well, first of all, maybe you should never have given Tesla all this interest-free money because it didn't get you your car any quicker. You know, the people who had deposits and made reservations got their cars at about the same time the people who didn't. The way the cars were handed out had almost nothing to do in the end with who had their reservation in first. So that was a big joke. And you just gave Tesla your money to use as an interest-free loan for all that time, and then Tesla took forever to get it back to you. And that's what the story was about. It's about how many people are having that experience. And you know, it didn't say it's the behavior is deliberate. It could easily be ineptitude. We see so much of that at Tesla. But it was good to have that kind of reporting out there. People can now read about, for example, in the cold weather, your doors won't open on the Model 3, or in the snow, the undercoating on it, that I guess is to dampen the sound, falls off. You know, not to mention the endless problems with leaking frunks and trunks, and they have all sorts of issues with this car. And they're being reported now, and that, I think that's a healthy thing. And Elon Musk thinks it's wrong. You should only write beautiful things about how wonderful I am.
Yeah, the other thing too was I've read on, I don't know if it was on Tesla Motor Club forums or if it was on Twitter, but there's also been stories not only about people not getting their refunds back, but about people getting two refunds back, about people taking delivery of their vehicle without paying for it. You know, things like that. People getting, you know, refunded twice. I don't know if I said that, but, you know, you read stuff like that over and over and you start to wonder, like, what are the internal controls look like here, right?
Well, PricewaterhouseCoopers just told us they're just fine. So don't worry about it, Chris. All these things where people are driving around a car with no title for months, right? With temporary tags. How about the fact that there's approximately 10,000 more claim deliveries than there are registrations for 2018? I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff with this company. But anyway, but I thought we should finish up by talking about the broken growth story, because I think that's the most important part. I think that's what finally moves the needle on the share price.
Sure. Can I ask you one question before we go on that? Because we'll do that
sure.
last. I had one more question for you, and just because somebody suggested that I ask this, and I'm curious myself, do you have an opinion on what Buswinkis leaving could do to the company's potential to raise capital going forward?
Yeah, that's a superb question. It certainly can't help. If you're the brokers going out, making phone calls to your clients, seeing who's in for the next capital raise and at what price. And you know that Fidelity has been shedding its holdings, and you know that T. Rowe Price has pared its holdings back. And you're worried that the word is going to get out about how weak demand is in the U.S. and Europe and China, and it has to get out. And now on top of that, you know, you've already had the problem with the revolving door at the C-suite with so many departures. And now on top of that, you have the general counsel leaving and kind of leaving abruptly and loudly and in the face of some flagrant violations of the consent judgment with the SEC by the reckless lying CEO. That becomes a tougher sell. This capital raise just became more difficult. Thank you very much, Elon Musk, for opening your mouth again. You know, if the guy could just shut up for a few months, he might be able to raise some capital. But his ego doesn't allow it. His narcissism doesn't allow it. His fundamental sociopathic personality doesn't allow it. I guess that's my opinion.
Yeah, that's a great answer. So let's talk about then the broken growth story, and certainly make whatever points you'd like about that.
Well, I think what has sustained the Tesla share price, besides a religious fervor, which you can never discount, and maybe, you know, I mean, the Roman Catholic Church has lasted for two millennia. Maybe Tesla will last despite any depredations it may commit.
Well,
who knows,
let me interrupt you real quick too, and just say up front, because what's going to happen is what the bulls are going to say to you before you argue this point, and what they're already emailing me with and telling me is, hey, you know, you said if the company could consistently turn a profit, that you would be wrong and the company would be right. And so
right.
Here we are, two quarters in a row posting a GAAP profit, and we've got these you know, seemingly incredible delivery numbers to sit back on. So, Mr. Skeptic, why won't you just admit you're wrong? You've been saying it's a broken growth story for several quarters now. What's different? And respond to that.
Well, first of all, you know, of the eensy teensy, first of all, if you take 2018 as a whole, Tesla lost $976 million. Okay. So, yeah, fine. You did two quarters with profit. In one of them, you harvested your highest margin Model 3s. In the next one, you achieved a record that you will never achieve again for deliveries, and your profit dropped, and your profit dropped, and you delivered 8,000 more cars than ever? Oh, come on. Now look at those numbers. In 2018, you collected $418 million of regulatory credit. You know, 100% margin, zero cost, regulatory credit, $418 million. In Europe, guess how much of that you'll earn by selling cars? Zilch, zero. Same in China. Okay, so you're now, you've exhausted your U.S. demand for all the high margin cars, even the Lemurs, the, you know, those middle range cars. It is appalling how tiny the demand is for them. It's being whispered, and you're going to look at the numbers. Even inside EVs, the best it could do for January was 6,500. And that's with the cars in transit at the end of Q4. And that's with the fact that Tesla promised anybody who didn't get their car on time that it would make up the federal income tax credit that they lost for them. January and February are just looking really bad. I think February is going to be worse than January. In Europe, they have maybe 20,000 orders, notwithstanding Elon Musk's statements to the contrary in the conference call. In Germany, you get 14 days to turn your car back if you're not happy with it. People over there are going to charge their cars and finding out they won't charge correctly. Why? Probably because Tesla just fired the company that it hired to help it get all these cars conformed to European standards and decided to do it itself. Regardless, I hope Tesla delivers its entire backlog in Europe in Q1. It will then be evident even more quickly how pathetically weak the demand is over there. And, you know, Tesla is going to deliver far fewer cars in Q1 than it did in Q4. Tesla will have a gap loss in Q1. I said if Tesla could achieve a gap profit for four straight quarters, I'm out of here. I stand by it, but it ain't going to happen. And, you know, I think Tesla almost – it almost has to explain if it wants to raise capital. You know, the story is now, well, you know, yeah, we're just slow to get our cars delivered to Europe, something like that. But then it needs to answer questions about what its order book really looks like over there. It's a broken growth story, Chris. All the fanboys have bought their cars, the U.S. demand is down to levels that are just tiny. Maybe it'll pick up again in, say, May or June when you have another cut impending on June 30 in that federal income tax credit, and it goes from $3,750 to $1,875. But they're out of gas in the U.S. They cannot make money on this car, selling it for less than, say, $44,000. There's only a couple levers they have left. One of them is to sell the short range car. That car is going to be so crappy, no one will want to buy it, and I don't think they can do it. I don't think they can make the car for that price and not get killed. So the only other real lever they have, and there's a guy named Jabberwock who wrote about this today at Seeking Alpha, is to start a leasing program. And they're going to do it not because they want to, but because they have to. And then, you know, you're going to see the leasing cost on this car is high. The insurance costs on Teslas are very high, higher than other cars in their class, because they're so easy to damage. They're so easy to total. They're so expensive to repair. And people have to wait for weeks or months for parts. And insurance companies are figuring this out. They have lots of very valuable, you know, almost real-time actuarial data that they analyze looking at all this stuff. So when you see that suddenly revenues are down deliveries are down. The company goes from profitability to suddenly losses again. And the outlook is bleak for the rest of the year. The European high margin demand will have been satisfied in large part in Q1, maybe a bit of carryover to Q2. There's no demand in China. The Model 3 in China is completely cannibalizing the Model S. The Audi and the Jag and the Daimler car, the Mercedes, are going to destroy Tesla's margins on the S and the X. It's already happening. The Hyundai Kona, the Kia Niro, there's the offerings from Nissan. They are all Renault. They are capturing a big part of the market, never mind before Volkswagen gets here with its EVs. And what does Tesla have in the pipeline? It's spending nothing on growth CapEx. How's it going to build this Model Y? You know, they put in their latest quarterly update that, well, we're probably going to build it in Nevada, but we're not 100% sure. They haven't even ordered any equipment for it. There will be no Model Y until at the earliest 2021, if Tesla lasts that long as a company other than in a reorganized form. They have no money to build the semi. They have no money to build their pickup truck. They have no money to build this Model Y. They've got nothing in the pipeline. They're not even keeping up with the superchargers they should be, with the service centers that they badly need. It's a catastrophe. And I think Dane Butsmick has probably saw some of that too. But I think it's finally the idea has always been Tesla's going to be this huge growth story. That Cathie Wood interview was all about how Tesla will, you know, one ring to rule them all. It's once it's evident that that's not the case, well, the cultists will continue to believe, okay? There's no stopping them. Once you believe in something, you're just going to believe in it forever if it's like a religious belief. But the T. Rowe Prices and the Fidelities and maybe even the Bailey Giffords and maybe even the idiots like Ron Barron, when they get slapped around hard enough and when enough people say, hey, why is my portfolio down this month?
Right.
The selling will start. And once it's evident that this is not a growth company anymore,
right,
then, you know, the people who have to go buy the stock in an offering say, well, I guess I need to look at comparables. And now suddenly, you know, they need a discount and you're down to 200. And then they start looking hard at the comps. And, you know, even if Tesla could achieve the profit it achieved in its record quarter, Q3, and do that four quarters every year, that's a PE multiple of 50. And if it's not growing and it's shrinking, how does that compare with a PE at, you know, Ford or GM of 6 or 7 or 8? That's what's going to finally, I think, cause it all to come tumbling down. The broken growth story.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that too, because that was going to be a follow-up question that I had. You know, I get this feeling, going back to what you said earlier, right, about Butsmick is leaving, and anybody in, I think, a sane and sober state of mind would expect that to have been something that spoke to the market, but as we both know, it didn't. And as we both know, a lot of these things that we perceive to be huge red flags are not speaking to the market, and the stock really does seem to have a bid here at 300 that just isn't going away, and we could speculate about that, but we won't. But my last question would have been to you. I think we both feel like this is a situation where the stock is taking the stairs up and will take the elevator down. And what I was going to ask you was going to be, you know, that morning or that week when reality hits, and it hits very hard, because I think we both think that will be the case. Is it more likely, and I know this is speculation, and as a lawyer, you probably hate it, but is it more likely that to you that would come as a result of a broken growth story, or would it come as a result of some type of binary event involving Elon Musk?
Well, it may come, as I've said before, from something that neither of us has ever even imagined. You know, there will be something that just never occurred to us that happens. But and when it happens, of course, who knows? That Tesla is now doing the best it can to keep the narrative alive and to say, you know, yeah, Q1 might be a little weak, but I promise you all these boats are now on the ship, so they're going to be delivered in Q2. And Elon Musk tweets out a photo of all the boats on the dock at Pier 80 or Pier 90 or whatever it is. But I think by the time you get the Q2 financial results at the latest, it's evident the growth story is over. Will there be something that happens before then? Who knows? With this company, something happens every day, right? Something every day. For all I know, Elon Musk could announce he's, you know, becoming a Buddhist monk tomorrow or checking into rehab or who the heck knows. You just never know.
And when we go back to Ahuja, you know, and you think about the timing behind him leaving, one of the things that I said on a way earlier podcast, probably a year ago, just about executives leaving in general, especially those executives that have something to gain monetarily from a stock price that appreciates, is the timing does matter, in my opinion. It's a very common sense. You don't need to be a financial analyst to understand that in a case like that, I certainly believe the timing does matter, because no matter what position you're in the company, whether you're the chief operating officer, or you're the senior VP of finance, or you're the general counsel, or you're the CFO, if you have equity awards that could potentially vest in your personal well-being and the well-being of your family and those that you love could be tied to the equity price, and you see some semblance of a runway ahead of you where, you know, things are looking good and things are looking optimistic, to me, it just doesn't make sense that you would pick that time to turn around and leave.
Yeah. Listen, that brings up an interesting point, and it also reminds me of one other thing I wanted to mention to you.
Cool.
But the point is, in the latest 10K, if you look at their executive compensation section and look at the amount of options that they granted over the past year,
yeah,
it's amazing. And look at the weighted strike price of those things. It has changed. It's much higher than it used to be. It's almost, you know, 270 or 280. That creates a... It points up a couple things. One, Tesla relies to a surprising extent for its revenues on option exercises.
Right.
Okay, that's pretty clear, which is that's a real risk factor, number one. And number two, with all these departures, to attract new people, you have got to offer them stock-based compensation on top of their salary. And with these strike prices getting higher and higher, the pressure to keep the share price high is enormous, okay, which creates its own risks. And, you know, the ability to attract them if your share price is falling or if the growth story is falling is really compromised. So, I mean, I would encourage everybody to go take a look at the 10K where it shows that history of the change in stock-based compensation between year-end 2017 and year-end 2018.
And that would – go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Please, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to change the topic. And
all right, so the last thing I'll say about that before you change the topic is that is just another thing to kind of add to the self-fulfilling prophecy on the way down, right? So it's not just the converts that are coming due that will have to be paid in cash instead of being paid in stock. And it's not just the CEO's possible margin call on top of the possible margin call of retail investors and investors of varying sizes. It ties in directly to employee morale. And you have a stock price that's already arguably as inflated or nearly as inflated as it's ever going to be. And you have, at the same time, employee morale not looking fantastic. What are things going to be like when these overworked employees who are bearing the brunt of the people they're taking over for that have been laid off see the price of the equity come way below their vesting price? And I think that is just one more thing to add to the self-fulfilling prophecy if the stock does move lower, which is why over and over and over again, I can't help but find it curious that the stock always seems to find a bid on days like today. And maybe it's nothing, but who knows? Go ahead and change the topic to what you're going to talk about.
Well, that's all right. I'm just pouring a little Curacao into my wine. There, done. Okay. point before the final point, penultimate point. If and when the company collapses, it's a tragedy for especially the employees, okay? And
right.
many shareholders too, but the employees. And to me, the best thing, the best chance that Tesla had to save a lot of these jobs and was to reorganize the company. It needs to shed a lot of debt. It has now, thanks to Elon Musk, some enormous contingent liabilities from these lawsuits over funding secured and over the SolarCity merger and related events. And those are pose immense dangers to the company. It needs to find a way to resolve them in a reorganization so that they go away and to become a smaller manufacturer of the high-end luxury EVs, which is what Tesla did the very best of all. It created this really desirable brand at the high end. And to have been thinking about a reorg and intelligently doing it and not paying the interest payment that they just paid, $48 million on February 15th, and not paying those converts that come due, $920 million on March 1st, those would have been very intelligent ways to conserve some cash until you put into place some debtor in possession financing,
right?
So that you had a chance of doing all this. But because Elon Musk's ego got in the way, a lot more people will suffer than needed to be the case. So that's a sort of penultimate point, and it's sad. The final point is this: I just, as a favor to me, you've agreed to do this, I know, but I want to mention it. There's a character at Twitter named El Gato Malo, which is the evil cat, and he has written one of the most insightful threads about how this so-called Tesla Q, this group of people at Twitter that share information, is an emergent system, and that by doing things like doxing Montana Skeptic, you bring it into existence, you make it stronger, you don't hurt it,
right?
You help it. And it's such an insightful system, and it gets back to so much of the thinking of, for example, Thomas Sowell in his brilliant book Knowledge and Economics, that I'm asking you as a favor for me to post that in conjunction with this
sure.
Podcast so that people can see it and read it. And do you need a link as well to that Matt Levine piece, or do you have that?
I will find that on my own, and the other one you provided for me prior to the podcast. So what I'll do for the people that are listening is I will put them in the thread where the tweet is for this podcast so that they can just go into that thread and the resources will be right there.
Okay, very much appreciated. And don't forget the warning at the beginning here, Chris, that who the heck knows when it ends or how it ends. So on it goes right now.
I did a lengthy disclaimer on both of our behalfs as well to start the podcast, and I just want to let you know I really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll talk again in a couple months, and please enjoy your wine.
All right, with the Curacao. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely, my kind friend. Thank All you right. so much. Talk to you soon. All right, that was the one, the only Montana Skeptic. Oh, it's good to hear. And as he's saying, the guy's a legend. Why? Because, well, Elon Musk helped make him a legend by doxing him and by trying to out him. And I forget who it was, but at the one of the, I think maybe it's Mandela. Somebody said, it's at the beginning of a Mos Def song where the guy says, you know, by striking me down, you're only making me stronger. And that seems to be the case. The song's Quiet Dog by Mos Def. I can't remember who the quote is from at the beginning, but somebody at the beginning of the song says, you know, you don't understand. By striking me down, you're only making me stronger. And that's the case with Montana Skeptic. Well thought out, well reasoned, very nice person, and a pleasure to have on. But right now it's time for me to go refill my wine as well, although I don't have Curacao. I don't know what he's doing over there, some fucking alchemy, some chemistry with his drinks that I don't know about. But real quick, before I do split, I'm going to just shout out one or two more patrons. Guys like Tommy B, who's been down for a minute. Travis Davis, I appreciate. My brother Mike Fenderson, hopefully you're on the mend, man, and getting better. Been thinking about you. My friends at Torch Basketball. My buddy Scott Beck. My friend Value Trap is in the house. Cullen Newland's in the house. Bryce Kiefer and Greg Kroll. Ladies and gentlemen, this was the QTR Podcast for February 20th, 2019. And that was the Montana Skeptic, and we are both the fuck out. Peace!